Your conference is being recorded.
Okay, we are now officially recording the conference call, Brett. So we're joined here live with Dana Love, Portfolio Manager at Dynamic Funds. I'll pass the line over to you to start the introductory proceedings.
Thank you, Matthew. So good afternoon and welcome to the Investment Planning Council conference call. This is exclusive to clients of your Financial Planning Center in Georgetown. So welcome. Sorry for the little bit of technical difficulty there at the beginning. The call will run from approximately 4 o'clock till 5. We have received some questions that we will be asking Dana to field at the end of the call. If you have any calls or if you have any questions post-call, by all means, feel free to send me an email, and we can get those specifics answered at the end. So if you have dialed in, or hopefully you've registered, there is a slide presentation that goes along with the phone. So hopefully you've had an opportunity to register. And as I say, there will be a replay available if you want to hear it back, or if there's been anybody that in the household that you wanted to hear it but didn't have the opportunity at this time. So this Dana is with Dynamic Funds, and my office and I personally, along with clients, we've been working with Dynamic Funds as one of our money management partners since 1992. And so, yes, this is our 25-year anniversary, 2017, of working with and serving families in financial planning. So congratulations to us and to you. So today the specific call is we'll be talking about the Dynamic Blue Chip Balance Fund. And this fund has been around since 1975, and it's been managed by various money managers. And those managers have been able to deliver consistent above-average returns. And according to Globe Advisor and Morningstar, the fund has actually been able to beat its peer group and its assigned index for all time periods, from 1 month right out to 20 years. And it's interesting to note that after costs, if you took the index compared to the after-tax result, sorry, after-fee result of the fund, the blue chip balance has actually beat its index by over 32% net of fees. So that's a fairly impressive result. And to my misunderstanding, it's rated as a 3-star fund on the Globe site. So go figure, as they say. So. You know, one of the attributes of Dynamics attributes has been their ability to attract and retain quality money managers. And so this along with other qualities that I identify in Dynamic has been able to maintain my confidence in them. And it continues to give me conviction in my ability to recommend Dynamic as one of the partners for money management for my clients. I'm pleased to say that. So this is, like I say, this is an exclusive and rare opportunity to have Dana present directly to our clients. And like I say, it is a rare opportunity. So Dana's been with Dynamic now since 2013. But Dana has more than 15 years of professional money management experience in the industry. He's been responsible for the management and oversight of global equity investments for various mandates and has held positions of head global equity manager at two Canadian asset management firms. Dana holds a master's of finance degree from London School of Business in London, England, and a Bachelor of Science in Sociology and Legal Studies from the University of Waterloo. And, of course, Dana is a chartered financial analyst designation, is a CFA, and that's definitely one of the priorities when we're working with managers. So with that, I'd like to turn the call over to Dana and have him give an overview on his process and on, as the title of his slide, the rationale of investing in irrational times. So take it away, Dana.
Well, thank you, Brett. Thank you very much. And it's a very nice introduction. I appreciate that. Thanks also to everyone who's taken the time to dial in today. And even thank you for anyone who might be listening to this on a replay mode if they didn't have time to dial in. I guess the approach that we'll take today is I think what's worthwhile is to kind of touch on three main areas. We'll go through an overview of the investment discipline and the process that we employ, essentially the guiding principles, if you will, that lead us through our investment decision-making process on a day-to-day basis as we manage the portfolios. And then we'll take a look at some brief comments, generally speaking, about the current investment environment, how we feel about it, the kinds of opportunities that we're seeing, and risks and challenges, which are just as great to identify as any opportunities that we might be looking at. And then hopefully we'll have some time for some decent Q&A too. Because that's always my favorite part of these things, frankly. To kick off, why don't we kick off just with a brief introduction, 2 seconds, but hopefully an important 2 seconds, on the team. The Dynamic Blue Chip Balanced Fund is managed by what internally here is positioned as the core equity team, which includes myself. And four other individuals, Vishal Patel and Amy Glading, who have been at Dynamic actually much longer than I have. They're veterans of the organization here, and they joined the team in December of 2015. And we also have Kevin Kaminsky, who actually came to join with me again here when we started in Dynamic in 2013. But he was also a colleague of mine, and we worked together very closely. He was an analyst on some of the portfolios that we were managing at our prior organization for 7 years. So we know each other very well, and we've been working together a very long time. So it's great that we've joined forces again. And then most recently, and you'll see that there's a face missing on the slides if you're looking at them. And that's because very recently we've had a new addition to the team, and his name is Danilo Martins, and he's a nice he's rounding up the team very nicely because first of all he's wired the same way as we all are in terms of our investment discipline, which we'll get to in a moment, and I'll go into some details into what that means. But the chemistry's great. He's a really great fit to the team. He actually was previously employed at the same firm that that Kevin and I were employed at prior to coming to Dynamic, which I'll just go nameless for that for the time being. But people probably are familiar with it. So we've got a third alumni from our prior organization joining us. And Danilo is a Brazilian national. He was born and raised in Brazil, moved to Canada in 2009, and he's been in the industry ever since. And very, very happy to have him join our team just a couple of months ago. So we'll get a photo of him, and then we'll complete this slide hopefully before too long. Okay, getting into really what we do and the process that we employ in our decision-making process, managing all the various portfolios, and importantly, this obviously applies to the Dynamic Blue Chip Balance Fund. What I have on slide three here is what I like to call the six principles of our investment process. Now, it's not a magic formula. It's not something that we go through and check off the check boxes every time we make an investment. These are the things that are ingrained in our thought process that just come naturally to us, that influence how we look at the world and how we look at the investment universe, and essentially identifies what we're attempting to do when we make an investment and what our mindset is. I guess that's the best way of putting it. And our mindset begins with the concept of what we are doing is we're investing. We're not renting pieces of paper on the stock market. What does that mean? Well, investing to us means that we're taking a fractional ownership interest in a business on your behalf. And we look at it as a business. We're buying shares in a business. It is actually a business, an organic institution, if you will, that, with people in it that manage it. And so our business owner mindset means that when we commit capital and we buy stock in a company on your behalf, we are becoming owners of that business, hopefully for the long term, and I'll get to that in a moment. But what we are not doing is, if I can use a disingenuous term, we're not stock jockeys. We're not flipping pieces of paper on the stock market. It's not a nameless or faceless institution or piece of paper or ticker symbol that we're buying and selling for a quick profit. We want to partner with businesses. I like to emphasize that term, partner, for the long term. And once we've made an investment, we really want the business to do the heavy lifting and to do the compounding on behalf of the investments that we've made on your behalf over the very, very long term, and that's where the value comes from. So we try to be as inactive, actually, in terms of as we can possibly be in terms of the turnover of the portfolio. We want the turnover rate to be fairly low. That's a byproduct of our investment process. So we make active decisions to make the investment, but once we've made the investment, from that point forward, if we've done our job correctly, we want to be as inactive as possible and let the companies do the heavy lifting with the returns. And to get there, we often have to think quite independently. Now, independent thinking in a stock market context is sometimes associated with, if not confused with, being contrarian. And certainly, I will admit, there is an element of having to have an original viewpoint and not always towing the party line and not always taking the consensus view when we make our investment decisions. But that's different than being contrarian just for the sake of it. We're not out there, being mavericks, picking the other side of the argument just for the sake of it. We're not saying something's black when other people are saying that it's white or vice versa, just for the sake of it. However, we use logic and facts to come to our own original conclusions about the decisions that we want to make within the context of an individual investment or how we construct a portfolio overall. And we do that independent of whatever outside influences there might be. And in this day and age, with all of the information that's out there in social media, traditional media, whether it's through the internet, whether it's through the television, whether it's through the mobile phone, there's no lack of information, and it can be deafening, and that's going to lead to another point that I'm going to touch on in a minute. But ultimately, we want to make the decisions that we make because of the conviction that we have based on the facts and the logic that we're using to employ judgment in our investment decision-making process. And if that means that we are contrarian and we're doing something that is different than what most other people are doing, then we're fine with that. We have the willingness and the ability to do so. And actually, we think that is an edge in the long term, because ultimately, if you're doing what everybody else is doing, by definition, mathematically speaking, you can't do any better than the average if you're always taking the average position. So we're trying to set ourselves apart from the crowd, if you will. And I mentioned the, for lack of a better word, but the noise that is often in the marketplace, and that relates to the third point, which is what I like to call the tempered temperament that we have to have in our mindset. I already described, you know, the various sources of information that are out there, more so in today's investing world than ever before. Sorry, there's a little bit of feedback on there. Okay, hopefully it will subside, but continuing, the trying to insulate ourselves from the noise and make sure that we're making logical decisions and not emotional decisions is something that we take very, very importantly, because ultimately, information is almost a commodity. It's what you do with that information that really makes the difference, and it's how you come to form a conclusion and exercise judgment on the information that's out there that is the source of value added. Right now, anybody can fire up their cell phone or their tablet or watch the TV, turn on Netflix, go to Facebook, go to the social media sites, and there is no lack of information. All the information that I have available to me, pretty much, is available to you, more or less. There might be a slight delay, but it's available to the world. So we have to sift through that and really figure out and decipher what is the difference between the signal and the noise, because the noise is just a distraction, but the signal has material content and information in it that can be useful. And that's really ultimately what we're trying to do, is decipher what the information is that's important to our investment decision-making process. And that means that we don't become pulled in emotional directions. So we don't become over-optimistic when everything's going really, really well. At the same time, we don't become distraught or overly pessimistic when things are not going well. We try to maintain an even emotional balance through the ups and downs of market cycles, through the ups and downs of any individual stock holding in our portfolio, and ultimately siphoning through all of the information that we have to, that actually, if you let it get to your emotions, it really can, but looking at it as objectively as we possibly can to figure out what really matters. And I mentioned earlier about our long-term approach, and that is central to our investment process, and I actually think it's one of the greatest advantages that we have. Again, tied to our investment mindset and our business owner mindset, not flipping pieces of paper on the stock market. When we are examining a company and deciding if we want to invest in it, we're looking at that opportunity not on what it's going to do for us, or more importantly for you, the investors in the fund, over the next quarter or 6 months or 9 months or 12 months or even 18 months, but ultimately over a multi-year time horizon. We're talking 3, 5, 7, 10 years. We look at a company and we assess it based on a full business cycle, which on average is about 7 years. Sometimes it's a little bit longer, sometimes it's a little bit shorter, but ultimately, it is a it's a multi-year time horizon that we're looking at, not months or quarters. And in the world that is becoming increasingly short-term focused, I think that's one of our greatest advantages, is the ability to look out long-term, and that we can add a lot of value by not being distracted by what's going on a day-to-day basis and the short-termism that's infecting the market. Last two points here on this slide, and then we'll move on. But at the heart of what we do, so that's kind of how we think of our approach. But what do we do? Well, we like to blend the art and the science of the investment decision-making process, or what I like to call the art component, is an inside looking out version of the investment decision-making process. What does that mean? Well, that means getting out into the real world and qualitatively assessing the businesses that we're looking at. By way of quick example,
Dana, can I interrupt? I just wanted to let you guys know that the screen is not updating, so it's staying on your initial screen. Just
okay.
But that's intentional.
Yes, that's intentional. Yeah,
okay.
I'm going through the points here. So we're at the second from the bottom.
Our slides are not moving at all. It's still on the first screen, just so you know.
Okay, so it's still on the title screen.
Yes, it is.
Okay. That is an issue then.
Okay, thank you.
Going to see what we can do here. In the meantime, for the sake of time, hopefully we get this sorted out. But
now it looks like they've got it sorted. So
okay,
John, it's got the 6 points there. So sorry, carry on.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. Okay, so we've been through 1 to 4. We're working on number 5, the second from the bottom. And to pick up where we left off about the art and the science, I was describing the art component as the inside looking out assessment of a business. And what does that really mean? And probably the best way to describe that is by way of illustration. So last month I was in Hong Kong, and when I was in Hong Kong, I spent an entire day with a company. I was meeting with not only the senior executives and the board of directors and even the chairman of the company, had lunch with them, but during the morning, went to one of their facilities where it's essentially a design studio, did a tour of their, of some of their new technologies that they're introducing, into the market, to better serve their customers and to assess what kind of an advantage that is for their customers. And it's something that they're offering their customers that no other company that does what they do, is capable of doing. And then in the afternoon went to a logistics facility, it's one of the largest logistics facilities in all of Hong Kong and in fact in all of Asia, and really saw how they actually procure, source, and distribute the products that they work with on behalf of their customers. And I'm being vague on the name of the company consciously here because we're continuing to do work on it. And if we decide to make a decision to buy or sell it in the near term, I don't want to compromise that by identifying it. So I am being a little bit vague, and that's by design, unfortunately. So it's maybe not the best example, but that is the kind of work that we do, and that's the art component of our investment decision making process, which differs from the science component. The science component is pretty straightforward. That's crunching the numbers. It's coming up with a valuation estimate on a business. It's doing all the financial statement analysis, reading the annual reports that you would expect of a portfolio manager or an analyst to basically scientifically and quantitatively figure out what a business is worth and ultimately, how profitable it can be, what its sales growth rates are likely to be, where it fits within the overall industry in which it operates, those kinds of things. But it's the art. But again, I think in this day and age where I talked earlier about all the information that flows around the world, in this day and age, there's obviously a lot of computing power as well. And increasingly, the science and quantitative component can be commoditized. Increasingly, our ability as portfolio managers, professional money managers, is sourced from the art component of the investment decision-making process, where we're able to hopefully employ superior judgment, take a longer-term time horizon, get out there into the real world to figure out what really makes these businesses tick, what's their source of competitive advantage, what kind of corporate culture do they have, and you can't uncover any of that information by sitting behind the desk and looking at your computer screen all day. So it's kind of an old-school way of investing, and that's what we like. And finally, but very quickly and equally as importantly as any of the points that have come before this, is that we try to minimize our mistakes as much as possible. And what does that mean? It means that we have an eye for trying to identify risks. We put equal emphasis and importance and effort into trying to decipher what the risks are when we're going to make an investment or considering making an investment, as we do what the potential reward is. We're not just looking at how much money we can make or what the investment is or the return is going to be if we make an investment. We're also trying to quantify how bad things will be if they don't work out according to plan and if they go against us. And ultimately, I think if you marry those two things together, they work out quite well, because economically they're the same thing. You can get ahead in investing by making fewer mistakes or making smaller mistakes, just as you can by making bigger returns. So they're really an inseparable part of the investment equation. Moving on to slide four. So if that's our mindset and our process and our philosophy, what is attractive to us when we're actually putting that into practice in the real world and looking for companies to invest in? Well, we kind of have what I like to call the three-hurdle framework. And so in order of importance, we're looking for companies that display the characteristics of, one, being a good business, two, being a good company, and then three, being a good value. And I call them hurdles because one comes after the other. And we start with the good business. So we want companies that are operating economically sound businesses, that have a high level of profitability, that ultimately, if you were an entrepreneur and you put yourself in the position of wanting to be in a business or own a business yourself, would you find that business attractive? And what are the elements of that business that you would find attractive that would draw you into that industry? So we're really looking at the underlying business, how the company makes its money, who its customers are, who its suppliers are, what the relationships are, what the industry structure is like, what the growth rates are like, what market shares are like, trying to decipher if, in fact, it's a good business. Once we clear that hurdle, we then try to find out if it's a good company. And there we're looking at some of those qualitative things that I referred to earlier, things like a corporate culture. Are management's incentives aligned with shareholders? Does the company have a track record of taking market share and outcompeting its customers? Does it allocate capital efficiently and productively on behalf of its shareholders? Those are just scratching the surface of some of the things that we consider to decipher if it's a good company. If we've deciphered that if we've cleared the first hurdle of it's a good business, we cleared the second hurdle that it's a good company, then we get to, is it a good value? And ultimately there, we're looking at things like sustainable return on capital, free cash flow yields, implied growth rates, and ultimately the rate of return that we think the company will deliver on a compounded basis, again, over a multi-year time horizon. And we need to clear all three of those hurdles in order for a company to be included in the portfolio. I guess I'll shift gears now a little bit in the interest of time and just kind of talk more or less broadly about the current investment environment. And because we are global investors and the Dynamic Blue Chip Balance Fund is a global balanced fund, there's a lot of territory to cover, and, you know, we could sit here and talk for an hour about all the things that are on my mind, but I'll try and keep it as concise as possible so that we can get to the Q&A. Where I'm going to start with an observation that I've been investing globally now for better part of 17 years, and I can say unequivocally that during the period of time that I've been doing this job, generally speaking, I have rarely seen valuations as high as they are, to varying degrees. Now, that isn't necessarily something to be concerned about as long as you're a long-term investor. But I do think, ultimately, the way the math works is that your starting point on valuations dictates your future long-term return. So we're, you know, just to put things in more context, if you look at the global financial crisis, 2008-2009, here we are in 2017. So we're you know, well along the road of recovery, if you will. To some degree, it's ironic because even though we're 8 years into a recovery, it really feels like we're just starting to get traction now, and that the prior 6 or 7 years up until this point have really kind of been littered with a few false starts, and we've really been trying to gain our footing in terms of stability in the global economy, again, to varying degrees, depending on the economic region that we're talking about. But at the same time, we are reaching record highs on most of the global stock markets, whether we're talking about the MSCI World Index or whether we're talking about the S&P 500. Many of the world's stock markets have done much better than the underlying economy. And so there's been a little bit of a disconnect between what we can all realize as a world that has been fraught with lower trend growth rates since the global financial crisis than those that preceded prior to the global financial crisis, and yet valuations have expanded and are at all-time highs. And we can cite all sources and try to explain that from many different ways, notwithstanding, obviously, the potential, whether you want to call it artificial or excess stimulus that central banks and fiscal policymakers, more monetary than fiscal at this point, depending again on the region, not necessarily in China where it's been a combination of both, but certainly around the world, central banks have been very liberal in bringing down interest rates. For the most part of 2016, we had the lowest interest rates in the history of the world since records have been kept. In many countries of the world were in negative interest rate territory, something that has never been experimented with, and I'm using the word experiment there, something that has never been experimented with before. It didn't work so well in Japan. People may or may not argue that it worked well in other parts of the world. I'd say it probably didn't. But coming back to the central point, regardless of what's been going on in the real economy, certainly valuations have risen for the better part of 8-9 years now, coming into 10 years from the nadir at the global financial crisis. And high valuations dictate your future returns. So if valuations are high today, then future returns are likely to be lower than average. You can't have both high returns and high valuations or ever-expanding valuations on an indefinite basis. Or at least that's the statement I'm going to make because it's never happened before. It'll be interesting. But a world of infinite valuations and infinite returns is not likely to happen. I think we all have to bet against that. So if prices are elevated today, we have to set our expectations a little bit more realistic for lower rates of return probably over the next 10 years than we've received since the global financial crisis, whether it's been 10 years or 9 years, depending on when you know, the exact month that you pick your starting point. Again, it doesn't mean, you know, a world that we need to be scared about if you have a long enough time horizon. It just means that from today as the starting point, we have to set our expectations appropriately. And I can say that kind of on the big picture level, to varying degrees, it does vary around the world. Just very quickly and superficially, I would say that right now, the U.S. is probably the most expensive region of the world. Europe is probably a little bit more reasonably valued. Japan is probably more reasonably valued still. And then we get to the emerging markets, which ironically actually are pretty much leading world returns so far this year, as they did for part of the back part of 2016. And then we can start to uncover value a little bit easier. Now, these are all very high-level, top-down comments I've made, but it's corroborated by the individual stock-specific analysis that I do. And the one critical thing that I want to leave you with, notwithstanding all of the comments that I've just made, is that there's no attempt in this portfolio to inject any top-down or strategic asset allocation overlay between geographies or sectors or industries. The portfolio is constructed entirely on the merits of the individual companies that we look at. And so all of those top-down comments that I made are observations that we can look at based on the data that we have. But at the same time, we're out there trying to find real businesses to invest in the real world. And it's becoming increasingly difficult for us to find that perfect blend that we seek in terms of the quality of the business, companies that generate a lot of cash flow, have dominant market positions, are leaders in their industry, solid balance sheets, don't take a lot of financial risk, and at the same time be able to pay a reasonable price for it. It's becoming increasingly difficult to do that on a stock-by-stock basis. So, what I said earlier is consistent with that as well. In a global portfolio, if you look at the Dynamic Blue Chip Balanced Fund, for example, right now, we're finding it extremely difficult to find new ideas in North America, including the U.S. and Canada. We're finding it a little bit easier to do that in Europe, and we've added a couple of new ideas to the portfolio from Europe this year. Japan, I would say we're starting to be able to identify a few more things. There's nothing that we've been acting on so far in the short term, but we do have a long list of companies that we're looking at. And then insofar as the Dynamic Blue Chip Balance Fund is concerned, it is a developed only market portfolio, so we're not really considering any of the emerging market ideas that we're looking at for this particular portfolio because we are using it as a developed markets only investment portfolio. But at the same time, there's probably more opportunities there that we're able to easily identify than there are in other parts of the world. Now, notwithstanding that, it's important to stick with that long-term view, I think, because the investment alternatives are obviously few and far between. If I suggested that equity returns over the next 10 years, picking today as a starting point, not rearward looking, but picking, you know, May 10th, 2017 as the starting point, if future returns are likely to be low in equities, I think, and particularly North American equities, they might be a little bit higher internationally, and so far we're seeing that this year. There are a few alternatives. Again, cash in the bank really isn't returning much. We know what the yields on fixed income is. That's not returning much. So overall, we're pretty much in a low return world. It is interesting to note too, just a little bit of a pattern, if you will, of kind of the volume back and forth that we've seen over the last 3, 4, maybe 5 years. Between the international markets and North America. And what I mean by that is, if you go back to 2014, North America clearly dominated world equity returns. It was basically the U.S., not so much Canada, but it was the U.S. that was a single horse race in 2014, and the U.S. delivered the vast majority of all of the global equity returns in calendar year 2014. Then we came to 2015, and the ball bounced back in the other court. The U.S. was a lagging market, and almost all of the global equity returns were sourced from the international markets. 2016, it was pretty much a North American game again. This time, Canada participated a lot more, but Canada and the U.S. really drove a lot of the global equity returns last year. And so far, here we are, not quite halfway through 2017, and again, it's ironic, this pattern. And who knows how long it will last. I certainly wouldn't want to bet that it's going to last too long, but it is an interesting pattern. But so far this year, the international markets, again, are leading the global equity returns. So just to quantify that very quickly, if you look at the S&P 500, in local terms, it's up about 8%, 7-8%. The international markets in Europe, the European markets are up probably around 10%. Japan is the laggard so far this year. It's up about 4%. Hong Kong and Asia is doing well, up low teens percent. Those are all in local currencies. The Canadian dollar has been very weak this year, so actually the returns for a Canadian dollar investor are much higher. And again, increasingly when you look internationally, a disproportionate source of the returns so far this year are coming from the international markets, and even the U.S., although it's doing well, up 7 or 8%, is still lagging. So what are we doing in this environment? Well, we're still sticking to our discipline. We're not deviating at all. And we're continuing to implement the process that I vocalized earlier. We're continuing to look for companies that clear our three hurdles. We're just finding it more difficult to come up with new ideas. The good news is that we feel very comfortable with the existing portfolio, and we're quite happy with it on a relative basis, whereby even if we are in a world of low returns, we think that the Dynamic Global Balanced Fund portfolio is relatively well positioned to weather any storms that may come down the road, and they certainly will. Unless the economic and the market cycle has been abolished, we will have another recession at some point in time. All of the businesses in the portfolio have staying power. They all generate high returns on capital and generate a lot of cash flow. And with a little bit of patience, I think they should reward people well. We're always looking for new ideas, but we're very hopeful on the portfolio. Now, obviously, you would expect me to say that. But we truly do believe that's the case, and we have a company that is filled with best of breed companies from around the world, and so that's what you hold. I often find it I wouldn't say frustrating, but interesting, because as a portfolio manager investing in real businesses, which is what we're doing with the Dynamic Blue Chip Balance Fund, I sometimes wish that you, the unit holders, could look at the individual companies the same way we do, because I think you look at it as a mutual fund, you look at it as a portfolio of companies or a portfolio of investments, which is what it is, so there's nothing wrong with that. But when you dig right into the virtues of the individual businesses that we own, it's very easy to get excited, or at least have confidence that the businesses in there, notwithstanding what might happen to the stock price in any given company on any given day, the businesses in there are very, very strong companies with virtues that will allow them to be market leaders and hopefully deliver above average risk-adjusted returns through market cycles, no matter what the market and what the stock price may do on any given day. They ultimately have sustainable survival power. So in a world of low returns, I think that's something that we can all at least hopefully sleep easy at night with. Having said that, the final message is that I guess I'll open it up for questions now, but ultimately turning to slide 7, the summary slide, if you will, just so you know that as holders of the Dynamic Blue Chip Balance Fund, really what you have done is you've hired us to manage your wealth, and we do so to the best of our ability every single day. And really what that means is we employ a disciplined investment process that I described earlier. We have experience doing what we do. We've managed other people's money through multiple market cycles, and we're a truly global investment team. So we're focused on that. We don't take the responsibility lightly. We take it very seriously, because ultimately it's not only our money, because we have some of our money in the products that we manage, obviously. It's not only our money that we're managing, but it is your money. And that's a great responsibility, and we're honored that you've entrusted us to do that. So with that, I'll open it up to questions.
Thank you very much, Dana. This is Brett Warby again. Yes, thank you for the insight. I think it's very valuable, and whenever I hear a manager with your conviction speak, it gives me great comfort to know that I can be looking at the financial planning aspect of my clients' portfolios and looking at their progress towards their objectives, knowing that you're at the helm on a daily basis. The art science of choosing choosing long-term sustainable companies, because after all, it is consistent sustainability that we require for our clients to meet their objectives. So thank you. So just again, the last point you made was one of the reasons that I choose to recommend Dynamic to my clients is because of the alignment that I see for myself and my clients with the interest of the portfolio managers. And you touched on it at the end regarding whether you actually have your personal monies in the same equities or ownership of companies that me and my clients would have. So I just, again, that's a kind of a public statement and for you to reconfirm that that's the case.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, we've been entrusted to manage a number of portfolios here at Dynamic and also through other parts of the organization. So we manage multiple portfolios, and obviously, given some of my earlier statements about the confidence, you know, if we're out there choosing to invest in what we believe to be some of the best businesses on the planet, and again, looking at it from a business person's point of view, which is how we do it, if we have the opportunity to invest in some of the best businesses on the planet and put them in the portfolio, we'd like to be along for the ride as well. So yes, absolutely, we're happy to be investors alongside.
Thank you. Dana, maybe you could give me a contrast. So last year, 2016 calendar year, clients would have recognized that the Dynamic Blue Chip Balanced was down about 3.5%. And as you pointed out, in a time frame that the Canadian market was up double digits. And yet, in contrast, we see a very marked difference this year. The blue chip balance up over 8%, and the Canadian market maybe up less than 2%. Can you talk a little bit about the contrast and maybe why that experience has been that experience?
Sure, yeah. It does deserve some explanation, and there is a very clear one. So if you look back to 2016, we being the core equity team here at Dynamic, assumed responsibility for the Dynamic Blue Chip Balance Fund. If, for those of you that have been holders for a while, you may remember there was a manager change, and the prior manager left just in December of 2015. So we took over management of the portfolios. And the prior manager really was focused on the North American markets in the approach to managing the portfolio. To that person's credit, by the way, because that was what his expertise was, he wanted to do the best job that he could for unit holders, and so focused on the markets where he had the best knowledge and felt that he could deliver the best edge. Now, when we assumed responsibility for the portfolio, we did transition it to be more of a global focused component on the equity side. It remains Canadian fixed income. Sorry, the fixed income side of the portfolio remains Canadian focused, but on the global on the equity side, we did evolve the portfolio to leverage, if you will, my team's expertise as being more global investors, and that's what I've done through my career. So there was a transition period that we went through as we came into 2016, unfortunately coincident with a year where, as I alluded to in some of my closing comments, the North American markets did very, very well relative to the international markets last year. Certainly Canada was one of the better performing markets in the world last year, as was the United States. So we went from a portfolio that was U.S. focused, North American focused, to a portfolio that was much more comprehensively global, and that meant more international exposure, just as the international markets on a relative basis underperformed the North American markets. So that didn't look very flattering last year. It was also, you know, complicated by the fact that we were going through a transition. But that was because we wanted to reposition the portfolio for the long term. That was a one-time event. It's not that we said, okay, we want to position the portfolio for calendar year 2016 to have more international content and then got that wrong. That wasn't the thought process. The thought process was, we are global investors. We're more global than the previous manager. This portfolio on a long-term basis should be more global, to leverage our expertise. And so we need to make this one-time transition. And as I said, it just so happened, unfortunately, circumstances as they were, that was during a year where the North American markets set themselves apart and were the best performing markets in the world on a relative basis. And then so far, again, keeping the story going here and consistent, so far in 2017, here we are, not quite halfway through, but the ball has volleyed back towards the international markets. And so what was working against us, I think, last year in 2016 has certainly been a tailwind this year for the portfolio overall. In terms of having a greater international component to it than was the case last year. And certainly I think it's benefited compared to if it was just a North American portfolio so far this year, it wouldn't have done as well as it has. And those are kind of like general statements, but obviously I would also like to think that we have added value by the individual companies that we've invested in. And although the transition in early of 2016 might have looked a little painful on a relative basis, making those decisions then are now starting to pay dividends at the individual company level. The investments that we chose to make a year ago are now starting to deliver.
Thank you. So, Dana, one of the hurdles that you indicated in the three-step process was good value. And my understanding to some extent is, like you say, is that not even the best company in the world is worth an infinite price. And so one of those things that you're trying to get right is being able to buy a company for less than you believe it to be worth. Can you try to give us a general sense on an overall basis in the portfolio, the equities portion, where it is in relation, the current value relative to the intrinsic value? In other words, would you put a number on where you believe that there's a value percentage available in the portfolio?
Sure. I understand the nature of the question, and I might not answer it directly, but hopefully that doesn't mean that it's a less valuable answer. So when I look at intrinsic value, we're investors that would prefer to pay a fair price for a good business than a cheap price for a bad business. So if we were trying to maximize discount from intrinsic value, if that was kind of our motivating factor in terms of how we look at valuing a company, that could lead us down the path of being deep value investors, and I certainly wouldn't want to mislead anybody by suggesting that that's the case. We are not deep value investors. We place a great deal of emphasis on the quality of the businesses that we invest in. So for us, we would rather have a smaller discount to intrinsic value for a higher degree of certainty on a particular outcome on a business rather than take a larger discount, but on a risk-adjusted basis, it might not be as attractive because the risks might be a lot greater. And there I'm referring to things like turnaround situations or companies that, you know, Warren Buffett has referred to as cigar butt businesses where they have one last puff in them and then they're kind of done sort of thing. If you buy them cheap enough, they can be rewarding investments. I'm not trying to convince anybody otherwise, but that's not our approach. Our approach is to invest in businesses at a good price and allow them to compound over a multi-year time horizon. So what that means is we, rather than try and quantify where each and every company in the portfolio is in aggregate, when you look at the overall portfolio relative to its intrinsic value, what we do is we like to look at what the implied growth rates are, what the implied returns are, and what the free cash flow yield of the company is. And on that basis, today, again, I would say for the quality of businesses that we own, which is quite high, I would subjectively suggest to you that we own much higher than average quality businesses. The portfolio is probably in the range of about 5.5% to 6% free cash flow yield, which again, in the low return environment that we seem to be in, I think is quite reasonable. The implied growth rates obviously vary greatly depending on the type of company, so you can't really generalize that as far as the overall portfolio portfolio is concerned. Some of them are very low, like no implied growth rates. In other words, we're getting all future growth for free. And we believe the company can still grow, but the market isn't pricing in any of that growth. And the long-term compound rate of return that we would expect is probably somewhere in the 7 to 7.5% range, which, again, that might not sound, too exciting, but I don't think we're in a world of exciting returns from the equity markets, generally speaking. And this is for a portfolio of very high-quality businesses. And just to qualify that statement, when I say the implied return, obviously there's margin for error in that, but that is a return in perpetuity. In other words, we reverse engineer out, based on our assumptions of what the company's operating characteristics are and the current price, what we think that that company will compound at if we held it in perpetuity. And if you were to compare a 7 to 7.5% perpetual compounding rate compared to, the fixed income market or the bonds or what you're going to get from a bank account or probably the general stock market, I think we have an advantage, certainly on a risk-adjusted basis.
Okay, thank you. And there are there's a number of companies I think that again you're owning businesses that you're owning the portfolio that our clients would be familiar with, Google, Microsoft, Oracle. But there is one I believe it's Fanuc, F-A-N-U-C, that they probably have never heard of, and I thought it's probably an interesting aspect to maybe give a quick overview of that company to give again. Clients a sense of how far-reaching your art is.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's a great and timely example that you suggest as well. And just for the uninitiated, anybody that's listening, that was not a planted company. Brett's asking about that one, so it's not one that we suggested he ask about. It is timely because I mentioned Kevin Kaminsky, who's an associate portfolio manager that works on the team that we've worked together. He just spent about 2 weeks in Japan last month, and one of the companies that he went to visit with, again, emphasizing our real-world research on the ground investment process, spent an afternoon with the company. And what's impressive about that is that Fanuc is a notoriously investor-shy business. It's been very insular. They don't often talk to the investment community because the company is still controlled and owned by a founding family that own about 30% of the stock and a disproportionate amount of the voting rights. which we actually find attractive in our investment ideas, because it allows the managers of the business the freedom to do what they think is truly in the best interests of the business in the long term, which is entirely different than having a professional CEO in place of a company that has no controlling shareholder, where they might be pressured to make short-term decisions to try and maximize things like short-term EPS growth or something like that, that actually have little to do with creating long-term value in the business, which is ultimately what drives that compounding power that we're after. So I'm not going to say that every company that we invest in has a controlling shareholder, but it is a virtue that we look for. And when we can find it, we'll take it. In the case of FANUC, it has it. That's great. And so for us to get access to FANUC, which, as I said, was FANUC, which was a it took a lot of work to actually get in the door, but we were able to do that, and Kevin spent an afternoon with them and really verified a lot of the thoughts that we had about the company, and gave us some incremental additional insight that we think is probably underappreciated about the company as well. But what is FANUC? Just very quickly, I already alluded to, it's a Japanese company. It is the world leader in each of its three business areas, which are industrial robots, robo-drills or robo-machines, and I'll describe what those are in a second, computer numerical control centers. And FANUC is the unrivaled world leader in each of its, with dominant market shares in each of those business areas. Industrial robots, that's probably self-explanatory. I'm sure we can all kind of envision what those are when you see a car being put together on the television, or a vial being handled by a robot in a pharmaceutical lab or something like that. Those are industrial robots. It's a consolidated market. There's really four companies in the world that compete. Yaskawa Electric, which is another Japanese company, ABB, and KUKA, which is a German company that was just recently acquired by the Chinese, so it might be now a Chinese company, depending on how you look at it, and FANUC. But FANUC is the world leader with, in the case of industrial robots, about 60% global market share. Robo machines, I alluded to those earlier. Those are basically tiny, smaller robots or work centers, if you will, that automatically put together things like the steel casings of mobile phones. So if anybody's bought, for example, an Apple iPhone in recent years, they've gone from plastic casing to metal casing. That's just one example. But a FANUC robot has put together the metal casing around your Apple iPhone. And then computer numerical control centers are something that are used broadly in factory automation. So they are actually the control centers. If you can just imagine like a computer with a keypad that you punch commands into in order to have the robots and various other things that go on inside a factory occur automatically and keep things timed properly. So it's kind of a technology business that is leveraged into the manufacturing of various things around the world. The great thing about FANUC is, again, it's the unrivaled world leader, as I mentioned, in each of its businesses that are growing phenomenally. There's increasing usage of robots. We hear about artificial intelligence and disruptive technologies like that play into the development of factory automation. Things becoming more automated as the world evolves, and as robots take a greater proportion of the manufacturing process, and various other applications. FANUC, being the world leader, is really set to take a disproportionate share of the value that's going to be created in the years ahead. And it's a very financially well-endowed company, for lack of a better word. It's a net cash company. About 16%, 17% of its market capitalization is in cash. It has no debt. It is managed very conservatively. It's focused on being the best company that it can be in its industry. It has very thick profit margins. In the peak of a manufacturing cycle, when everything's just humming along very nicely, in certain product categories, those operating margins can be in the high 40 to 50% range. In the trough of an economic cycle, including something as severe as the global financial crisis, the company still had double-digit profit margins. It still made money. And if you can think back to how bad things were during the global financial crisis, with all sorts of manufacturers going bankrupt and all sorts of business failures, many of its customers were not healthy. The company still delivered double-digit operating profit margins. The return on capital in the company is in the high 30% range through a cycle. Obviously, it fluctuates. It's higher at the peak of the cycle, lower at the trough of the cycle. But on average, it's about 37%. And obviously, given all of those financial characteristics that I've just rhymed off, it generates lots of cash, more cash than it needs. So the company is becoming increasingly shareholder friendly. It's buying back and canceling shares, and it is being more progressive in its dividend policy, which has always been fairly stingy, frankly, historically. But the management team and the family is opening up and starting to implement a more consistent dividend policy as well.
Well, thank you very much, Dan. I think that's very insightful. Like I say, it helps us understand the wide-reaching viewpoint and landscape that you look at, and just through statistics and the information we get, we believe most Canadian investors to have a very high home bias in their investing, and it's definitely one of the tenets that we talk to our clients about is that a large portion of the best companies and best capital allocators in the world are actually outside of Canada. I don't mean that to sound unpatriotic, but after all, it is our pension that we're looking at. So that's a great insight. So I want to thank you once again, listening to you, as I have many times. I always come away with bolstered confidence that a person of your expertise is at the helm of one of our mandates, and I believe that clients will appreciate the opportunity to hear somebody like yourself. We continue to, you know, offer opportunities to help clients understand what our manager is doing for you. And like I say, in absence of value, people start to question, you know, price. And I think that this demonstrates value both on Dynamics front as well as ours. So I want to thank you for providing us with the rare opportunity to speak directly to clients and to give us this exclusivity. And I look forward to a long and continued prosperous relationship. So thank you very much.
Thanks again, and thanks to everyone that participated, and thanks, Brett, for hosting. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. And as I indicated, the call has been recorded, and we will be sending out details to for those who haven't been on the call, so on how you can access this call. So thank you again, Matthew, for organizing, and you guys have a great evening. Thank you.
You too.